It is a commonplace of a certain kind of broadcasting or writing that the writer or the broadcaster says, now for a moment of full disclosure, what usually expects, he will then talk about having been convicted of wife beating or perhaps confess that he's a defrocked Buddhist priest. I have my moment of full disclosure right now. My guest in this recording is David Satter, one of the first-rate journalistic observers of the Soviet Union and of the Russia that followed. And David Satter was, and this is my full disclosure, once my student. You do remember that, don't you?
Oh, very much so.
And from the University of Chicago, where you got your bachelor's degree, and where you were the distinguished editor of the student newspaper, you went on to Oxford for graduate training, and then came back to Chicago, and you followed the cops for a few years.
That's very true. 4 years on the night beat at the Chicago Tribune.
And then to, of all places, Moscow, working for the London Financial Times.
That's right, that's right.
So what was it like to wind up, let's see, what year is that you arrive in Moscow?
I arrived in Moscow for the Financial Times in 1976, and I was destined to stay there for 6 years. Yeah. During the height of the Soviet regime, the period when Russia was at the height of its world power.
These are the Brezhnev years, if I remember correctly.
Yes, yes.
And Stalin is gone, and supposedly there's been, if not a thaw, that came later with Khrushchev, supposedly, there is at least a loosening of the tight and terrible binds that were imposed upon the Russian people, which involved, among other things, killing lots of them.
Well, absolutely. The terror, the mass terror, came to an end after the death of Stalin. Khrushchev began to free hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, of prisoners from the labor camps. And the society was changed as a result. He also publicly acknowledged that Stalin had been guilty of atrocious mass crimes.
That was in the secret speech, which remained secret for about a day and a half, as I remember it.
It was never intended to be secret. It was it was made before the Central Committee of the Communist Party, but it was in the hands of Western intelligence almost immediately. Really leaked to them by European communists who were authorized to do so. So it was never intended to be secret, and of course, you know, how can you consider a speech to be secret when it's given before hundreds of people who then leave the hall in a state of shock and start talking about what they've heard? But in any case, it was a real breaking point for the totalitarian regime.
It revealed many of the crimes of the Stalinist regime and was already a little short on the complicity of various other Stalinist loyalists and Stalinist Politburo members, among them the maker of the speech, Nikita Khrushchev, who indeed had a lot of blood on his hands from the repressions in the Ukraine, which he administered for Stalin, if I remember correctly.
Yes, and not only in Ukraine. Khrushchev betrayed even some of his closest friends and co-workers, those whose innocence he could not have been in doubt. But it was a period of such mass insanity that really to remain in a leadership position and resist was an option that was not considered realistic by almost anyone. There was one person, Sergei Orchenikidze, who committed suicide, apparently in order to avoid participating in these mass crimes.
Well, other possible resistors essentially committed suicide by agreeing as they went on trial in the famous purge trials of 35, 36, and thereabouts, who agreed that they would lie about their complicity as agents of one or another foreign power, particularly for the Queen of England, rather the King of England, and went to their deaths after their confessions. These were men, Bukharin and various others who might have made some trouble for Stalin, or would they have?
At that point, Stalin had such complete control over the levers of power that it's unlikely that they could have. There was opposition, but it was really dealt with considerably earlier. I mean, the mass purges and the purge and the show trials took place basically after resistance to the Stalinist regime had been pretty much extinguished. As for the alternative that Bukharin and others like him had, I'm not sure that they indeed did have much of an alternative. The fact is that protesting therein, these trials were carefully rehearsed. A one word deviation from the pre-agreed script would have led to the interruption of the process, and these people had been promised that if they admitted their crimes, they would be allowed to live. And Stalin and his henchmen also threatened their relatives. So all those who worked with them, situation was created for them in which they felt they had no choice.
Even though they lied for Stalin, none of them, in fact, were allowed to live, were they?
I believe there were one or two of the minor figures who may have escaped execution, at least for a time. But the overwhelming tendency was for them simply to be executed.
And what is even more remarkable about the Stalin years is not merely that he killed many of his original associates and defrocked and ultimately deported and or killed many members, hundreds of thousands of members of the Communist Party, but he went after the general population of the Soviet Union, both the great Russians and the various ethnic minorities, and by shipping them essentially off to the Gulag and by yet other means, including forced starvation early in the regime, he is accountable, Stalin is, and his associates are, accountable, the estimates vary, but possibly for 60 million deaths. As Rudolf Rummel, who studied all of these matters, a political scientist focused on genocide and what he calls democide, the total for Stalin runs upwards of 60 to 70 million.
I think that it depends how we arrive at that figure. He's probably including the victims of the Russian Civil War and of the Second World War.
No, he does not include killed men in uniform. It does not include war deaths, though he does include deaths of civilians.
Well, the figure that I've heard and that I consider most reliable, the first thing that has to be said about this is that it's practically impossible to know exactly how many people died.
Oh, of course.
The numbers are just unbelievable. And in a way, it doesn't change anything if it's 60 million or if it's 20 million. The figure that I used in my book was 20 million, excluding the 20 million persons who were done to death either deliberately or as a result of a situation that was created by the Bolsheviks and could not have done otherwise than have resulted in mass death.
And that would have been, for example, the exactions in Ukraine, where they essentially took all of the wheat crop and other things and sent them off for foreign credits, leaving Ukrainians to starve, which was convenient because they wanted to get rid of peasant landholders.
Yes, this not only Ukraine, but the 1932-33 famine also affected Kazakhstan, the Volga Valley, the North Caucasus. It affected some Russian regions as well. The point here is that they adopted measures which could not but have led to mass death, and they were ready to do that.
We do have horrifying quotations, whether apocryphal or reliable, but attributed to Stalin, about the necessity for getting rid of men who pose problems. And the fact that though one man's death is a tragedy, the death of a million is merely a statistic, a kind of a coldness and even a sort of a celebration of the quality of control over life and death, underlined death, that Stalin held for so many years.
Well, this is because of the reversal of values, the kind of anti-values that are common to all totalitarian regimes. They put the objectives of the regime and the predictions of its ideology ahead of the fate of any individual or individuals. There are no kind of transcendent moral rules that apply equally to the state and the individual in the case of a totalitarian regime. The absolute, the ultimate measure of morality is whatever suits the interests of the regime.
Is it possible, as some historians have speculated, that that Stalin's depredations, which came earlier, provided a kind of a model and even possibly a kind of a justification for both Hitler and for Mao Zedong?
Well, I think that certainly Hitler was very well aware of the terror in Russia, and he was aware of the methods that were being used in order to impose Soviet ideology. And we can only speculate, but that is a very convincing line of argument as far as I'm concerned, because what the Bolsheviks did was that they attacked the moral framework of the whole world by insisting that there were no higher rules that applied, that the highest rules were those that served the revolution. Lenin made this explicit in his speech to the Komsomol after the Bolshevik takeover, in which he said that as far as we're concerned, there is no such thing as abstract universal morality. For us, what is moral is whatever serves the interests of the revolution, and what is immoral is anything that stands in the way of the revolution. Well, Hitler did not change anything very fundamental. All he did was he changed the identity of the absolute. In other words, it was no longer the socialist revolution or the interests of the working class, but rather it was the national socialism and the interests of the master race. It was basically the same idea. And of course, Stalin, with his absolute ruthlessness, provided an example for the Asian communists as well, because they were just as fanatical, if not more fanatical, than the Russians. The idea, the notion that there is no God, there's only the party, those words were first uttered in Russia.
You've tracked Soviet and then Russian history in three different books. I know a fourth one is in the works right now. The first was titled The Age of Delirium, The Decline and Fall of the Soviet Union. One notes there instantly the borrowing from Gibbon, quite appropriate. The decline and fall of the Roman Empire is recapitulated by the decline and fall of the Soviet Union, except that the Roman Empire, depending upon how you measure it, if you measure it from the establishment of the empire with Augustus, runs for some 400 or 500 years, and it persists in the east, that is around Constantinople, whereas the Soviet Empire ran for, 70 years?
Yeah. I mean, there's an interesting quote from Gibbon. Gibbon said that what amazes us about the Roman Empire is not its extent, but its longevity.
Sure.
Whereas in the Soviet Union seemed to be at the height of its world power, and yet it collapsed with very little effort to resist its own demise. and it collapsed literally like a house of cards in just a few years.
But an incidental question on the route. We could easily spend hours on this one, and many have spent many books on this, but I just pose it quickly. Yes, but why did it last even 70 years? Why did not the Russian, more broadly, the Soviet population, as their relatives were being taken away and killed, and as life became so unbearable, why did they not simply revolt and create a new Russian or Soviet revolution which undid the communist one?
The terrible reality is that the Soviet people, by and large, supported the regime, and although they were aware of its crimes and they were fearful, they bought into the idea of socialism. The Soviet regime created an entirely new social system. And to a certain extent, it created the type of personality on a mass basis that was very well adapted to that system. You have to wonder, people often compare Stalin, the communism and Nazism, but in fact, they're similar in some ways and they're different in other ways. The ideologies are different, and Nazism was just kind of a prescription for endless murder, whereas communism strove to create something. What they created, of course, was extremely frightening. But nonetheless, once the Soviet system had been created, once a communist system had been created, the need for continual mass terror disappeared. People were already organized to live in the new system. So the question then is, what was the new system? What was appealing about it? And I think that as much as we condemn it, we have to understand that to understand the weaknesses of communism, you also need to understand its strengths. For one thing, it guaranteed cradle-to-grave security. Everyone had a job. Everyone had medical care. Everyone had education. Everyone was provided for. Provided for, I must add, at a very low level. But nonetheless provided for. Everyone was the subject of an ideology that treated Soviet citizens as if they were the vanguard of humanity, as if they were bringing enlightenment, not just to their own country, but to the whole world. And this gave a sense of meaning to what were otherwise very miserable and oppressed lives. People enjoy, and we see it in this country, we see it all over the world, they enjoy the sensation of having an answer to every question. And Soviet ideology gave people that opportunity.
Yet there was a movement towards liberalization beyond the death of Stalin and then Brezhnev and the others who died rather quickly. We then get the emergence of Gorbachev, who really is for liberalization with Glasnost and so on. And the people seem to welcome that. And then there's a coup to try to knock that over and to return to something more truly Stalinist. That you handle in that first book of yours, the first Russian-Soviet book, The Age of Delirium, The Decline and Fall of the Soviet Union. But that attempted counter-coup doesn't last for more than a few months, as I remember it.
Well, we have to understand that the kind of system that was created for people in the Soviet Union was extremely unnatural. It was based on an ideology which was founded on lies, was a false science, which was imposed on people and which they were obliged to act out. The Soviet system transformed the Soviet Union into a nation of actors. People were not concerned with what really exists. They were concerned with what they had to pretend existed. And as long as that fictitious world, that fictitious universe was untouched, it was extremely resilient. once Gorbachev began to allow free information in the hope of making the system more dynamic, he actually signed the death warrant for that system, because people, there was no way to control the revelations. One revelation led to a second revelation, led to a third revelation. And Gorbachev was in a situation where he was constantly faced with the choice of either admitting he had been wrong to start the process and imposing repression, or allowing the process to go further. And he had a real fundamental incentive to continue the process, because the people who were making these revealing this information were his partisans. They were his supporters. But once that happened, all the hidden fault lines in Soviet society were exposed. The national conflicts, the labor conflicts, the history of mass repression, everything about which people had not spoken and about which it was dangerous to speak, now came to the surface and now began to be discussed. And
that was what
exploded the Soviet system.
And is that why the coup against him could not succeed in long term, though to be sure it did displace him permanently from the higher levels of Russian politics. That's where, in fact, after the generals and the old Bolsheviks are displaced, the guys who made that coup, that's where Yeltsin emerges.
Well, yes, but the point is that the Soviet Union, with its ideology intact, could count on the police, the army, the KGB to repress any type of disturbance. But once, after 4 or 5 years of glasnost under Gorbachev, in which the ideological assumptions of the system had been thoroughly discredited, the coup leaders who took over in 1991 could not rely on the army, the police, or the KGB. And in fact, it was the refusal of the KGB's special alpha unit, their anti-terrorist unit, to storm the White House and take out Yeltsin that doomed the 1991 coup, and in fact sealed the fate of the Soviet Union.
And Yeltsin rises, and very quickly he establishes and presides over the dismemberment or the disestablishment of the Soviet Union itself.
Yes, of course. Now, we shouldn't overestimate the virtue of Yeltsin in this. The structure that existed after the collapse of the coup was the Soviet Union ruled by a Soviet president who was Gorbachev, and the Russian Republic ruled by a Russian president who was Yeltsin. In order for Yeltsin to become a full-fledged head of state, he had to eliminate Gorbachev. And if the only way to do that was to break up the Soviet Union, he was perfectly willing to do that. And in fact, that was a very strong motivation in other parts of the Soviet Union. The Ukrainian communists, for example, began to consider a situation in which, instead of being dependent on Moscow, they could be rulers in their own right.
Yeah.
And that was very tempting.
Jumping forward, as one must, in this quick overview of the major points in recent Soviet and then Russian history, we go to your second book, which also has a title drawn from or playing with a previous and rather classic title, Darkness at Dawn, The Rise of the Russian Criminal State. Darkness at Dawn, of course, is playing with Darkness at Noon by Arthur Koestler, which refers back to the Stalinist period. But what are you dealing with in Darkness at Dawn, The Rise of the Russian Criminal State, the book published in 2003?
Well, in Darkness at Dawn, I was talking about what happened after the fall of the Soviet Union. And in particular, the rise of a criminal oligarchy, which is still in charge in Russia, and the failure to establish a decent liberal democracy. And I tried to examine why that happened and to show the process through which Russia became what it is today. And book has been reissued in Russian, part of it, not the whole book, but part of it in Russian with the title How Putin Became President, and is now a bestseller in Moscow, I'm pleased to say.
One of the things that book deals with is the campaign undertaken by Putin and his associates to reveal the full extent of the Stalinist horror, the bodies by the millions found every place where they began to dig up in old Soviet territory. And thus an anti-Stalin surge, which for a while became a kind of national preoccupation. But you say that that has now faded out for certain legitimate reasons. And that's what you're dealing with. I want to come directly to the most recent book published in 2011. In the book, again, wonderfully titled, It Was a Long Time Ago and It Never Happened Anyway, Russia and the Communist Past. They're having started to expose the communist past, they're now beginning to deny it once again, you say.
Well, they exposed it during the Gorbachev period, during the period of glasnost and perestroika. And it had a massive psychological effect. It was a tremendous shock to Russians to know that their history, far from being glorious, was actually a set of atrocities. And and history became a preoccupation in Russia and in the former Soviet Union in a way that it rarely is in any country. But there was a reason for that. And the reason was that history could be used, the truth about the past could be used as a political weapon against the communist regime. And as the communist regime lost popularity and lost legitimacy in the eyes of the population, it was these revelations about, you know, the Stalin period, about Lenin, about, you know, all of the crimes that had been covered up for so long that energized people and made them determined to change the system. Problem with that was that, and it was foreseen by many people in Russia, that once the Soviet Union collapsed and this history lost its usefulness, the number of people who would be committed to a moral reckoning with history, with, you know, who understood the moral imperative of memorializing the victims and fully exploring the past shrank to just a handful of people. And history ceased to be an issue in Russia. And then when Putin took over and began the process of rebuilding the Russian state, which had been in kind of disarray under Yeltsin, and consolidating his own dictatorship, he, of course, drew on these chauvinistic traditions that do exist in Russia and began to justify and then, in some cases, even to glorify the Soviet past. Well, against that background, there was no further need for exploring the truth about Soviet atrocities.
And so these days, we do more with Soviet atrocities in the West than they do in Russia.
I think that there's much more interest in the West and much more concern for the victims than there is in Russia itself.
Can they ever somehow evolve to a more effectively functioning democratic society without fully confronting the horrific history of the Stalinist years?
I don't think so. I think that the core problem for Russia is a lack of respect for the individual,
yeah.
The notion that the individual counts for nothing compared to the goals of the state. This is the Ariadne's thread that runs through really the whole of Russian history. The notion that the fate, the individual personality, the individual human being has no real significance. What matters are the glorious projects of the state, its political ambitions, its imperial reach, its glory. Individual doesn't count for anything. And as long as, and the attitude toward the victims of Stalinism is very much consistent with that
yeah.
view, because you'll hear in Russia, just hair-raising statements such as, yes, the victims were, it was terrible, the Ukrainian famine, but the industrial achievements of that era stand as a monument to those who died. The idea being that, well, yeah, they did starve to death, but look at, the industrial plants that we were able to build with the exported grain which could have been used to feed them, and that should be a consolation to them. Something that it's so outlandish and so bizarre that it's hard to believe that normal people could say things like that, but they do, and that's something that's thought in Russia.
And so we come to more or less the present moment, and the central figure of Putin, who has been in power, even though for 3 years or so he put one of his acolytes in power as president and served merely as, quote, prime minister. But it's been the Putin era for quite a number of years now. And it's been a kind of government distinguished by many things, perhaps deserving the title it's received by some, namely the kleptocracy, the Putin kleptocracy, which means essentially the elevation of the thieves.
Well, this is what has happened. I mean, it didn't start with Putin, though. It started with Yeltsin. You had a situation in which no one had any money, and the state had all the property, and the process of putting property into private hands was run by the state. This meant that corrupt ties to bureaucrats and members of the government were absolutely essential in order to amass great wealth. And the persons who became known as the oligarchs, they became wealthy because of their corrupt connections.
By the way, how did they so quickly become not merely multimillionaires, but billionaires? What's the particular kind of fake-out operation by which you somehow command the wealth that reposes in whole industries?
Well, for example, there was Vladimir Gusinsky, who was the head of the Most Bank. He established that bank with funds from the city administration, and he was given authority to pay the bills of the city of Moscow. So he simply did what many of the others did, was he held on to the money, collected interest on it, held on for as long as possible. Many people waiting for the money could not pay their employees, and built up quite a fortune that way. Another method was to take advantage of the difference between the domestic price of oil, which was controlled and was very, very low, and the world market price. Somebody who was given a license to export oil was basically given a license to print money. He could buy oil at the internal price, sell it abroad for the world market price, and keep the difference. Now, you can well understand that to get those export licenses, you had to pay bribes. So what happened was that wealth began to depend on your ability to bribe officials. You bribed one official to get a favorable decision, which gave you access to budgetary money, and with that money, you were in a position to bribe an official who was higher up, and the ability to bribe the highest-ranking officials was a guarantee of great wealth. Wealth that's, Russia, at a time when the country was suffered, an economic collapse worse than anything that was ever been experienced in the U.S., was producing more billionaires than virtually any country in the world.
Does Putin get his cut? If you have to bribe, do you bribe at the very top and make Putin a millionaire? A billionaire, rather?
Well, we have reports that he is a billionaire. And in fact, there are reports that he is the wealthiest person in Europe.
Uh-huh.
And that he owns, that many vital, particular industries in the energy sector are controlled by his confederates, and that they, in fact, are only front men for Putin himself. We don't have proof of this, but it's highly credible and it's widely believed, and it's in the nature of things that getting direct proof would be difficult.
Now, David, does the general Russian public understand this is happening, and are they in protest, or are they willing to go along with the game?
Some people don't understand. Some people suspect it may be true, but are just too tired of all this misrule to protest. They prefer to accept even a corrupt ruler because they fear instability and the consequences of an open contest for power. At the same time, they're deeply convinced that even if Putin steals, somebody who took his place would be no better.
And is there a sometimes free press in Russia which is reporting on this and acquainting the general public with what's being done?
There are some newspapers who have tried to report on this and in some cases have reported very successfully, but the problem is that these publications reach only a limited number of people, and the regime controls national television, which is the principal source of information for most Russians. I mean, we've got a kind of bifurcated informational situation in Russia in which a small number of people are getting critical information from limited circulation news, but limited by comparison with the television, of course, and the internet, and the mass of people who depend on television, state television, through which they are thoroughly propagandized.
Of course, the regime does, I gather, occasionally throw into prison or even kill some of its competitors who are trying to amass wealth in a way that doesn't suit the other kleptocrats, or who are true critics. There is a repressive use of the punitive system, is there not? If not equivalent to Stalin's use of it, but still enough to keep the lid on.
Well, yes. I mean, the authorities control the system of justice, and they are able to assure that they get the verdicts they want, particularly in political cases. They control the prosecutor, they control the judges, they control the police. And the system of justice does not work impartially by any means. At the same time, control over law enforcement is exercised through the with the help of bribes, and people use law enforcement in order to ruin their competitors. If I want to take over the business of my competitor, I don't compete with him. I don't try to drive him out of business by producing a higher quality product than his. I bribe law enforcement to try to charge him with a crime.
Yeah.
And there are thousands of entrepreneurs, businessmen sitting in Russian prison, in pretrial detention in Russia right now, who've been put there by their competitors.
Ah, thousands, you say?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's... the ultimate question, of course, is how does this serve or fail to serve the broad mass of the peoples of at least the Russian Republic? And how does it affect those of the outlying governments who were once part of the Soviet Union? There is the demographic reality, a strange demographic situation in terms of population loss and in terms of very low levels of longevity.
Well, the whole situation is very destructive for Russia. Russia is in many ways a dysfunctional society. It's a society in which people are unhappy, from which many people are emigrating. They have had there was a recent poll in which an astonishingly high percent of Russian young people said that they would like to leave the country. I mean, it was something like 40%. Now, of course, not all of those people will succeed. Not all of those people would act on their desires. Nonetheless, it does show something. And beyond that, you have a very high death rate, very low birth rate, falling population, crumbling infrastructure, all of the things. And you have galloping corruption. So, and a country that's dependent on the export of energy, of oil and gas. Well, under these circumstances, the country could sooner rather than later, perhaps, face a systemic crisis.
You've gone back there many, many times, and I know you're about to depart for yet another stay in Russia. The ultimate question is, what will become of them? What are the alternative futures that you can envision?
Well, the thing is that there's a new Russia that has developed since the fall of the Soviet Union, which has had the experience of freedom. Of course, it's not freedom of the type that would exist in the West, but nonetheless, compared to what existed under the Soviet Union, it's very considerable. They've been able to travel to see the outside world. There is a stratum of Russian society that consists of people who are very worldly and very European, who want to see a democratic future for their country. The problem is that the bureaucracy and the regime are pretty much what they were. In spirit, at least, they aren't that much different from what they were under the Soviet regime. So you have this potential conflict. And we saw it with the demonstrations at the end of 2011 and in early 2012.
They were protests against stolen elections, basically, were they not?
Stolen elections, but also against the corruption of the regime, against Putin himself. I think that it's going to take, though, a real level of spiritual awareness, a real commitment to the role of the individual, to the dignity of the individual. And so far, that is not evident. We need to see, I think, what Russia needs to see is a readiness to memorialize and honor the memories of those who were murdered by the regime. That in order directly to contradict the notion that the individual and his fate have no importance.
Ah, so that's what you had in mind when you said at the end of an article from the Wall Street Journal last year, and I quote, The stage is now set for a struggle over Russia's future, in which neither side can be confident of success. What is at stake is not just the country's prosperity, but its existence as a civilized society.
Yeah, I don't think these crimes can be buried. I think this was German society understood, at least, maybe perhaps not immediately. My impression was that after the war, Germany was in a state of denial too, to some extent. But I think that what we see in Germany is a recognition that you can't go halfway. You're either going to expunge this tendency, this poison from the political organism, or you'll have to live with a chronic infection for your whole, for the whole course of your existence.
But you have said that for the Putin bunch, they can't expunge this horror and face all that they should remember clearly and with bravery, because that would...
Oh, they have no desire to.
You say that would undermine their regime. How would it undermine them?
Well, it would undermine their regime only indirectly, in that it would help to support the democratic consciousness, which does not really want to be ruled forever by one man, and which does not want a system that's based on corruption rather than on honest dealings.
David, this is a fascinating review that you've done, and it's very well presented, of course, in your three fine books, and the fourth that you're working on now, and that will shortly come. It leads us, though, to the ultimate question, at least for the present discussion, and that is, what's going on between us, and more broadly between Europe, I suppose, but between us and Russia, the contretemps, standoff between our president and Putin at the moment, the recent Snowden problem, which I suppose officially persists. What's the situation between them and us, and what should be done?
Well, I think that what we face now is a situation in which the regime is no longer sure of its future. The demonstrations that took place in December 2011 and in 2012 rattled the regime and deprived them of the confidence that they once had that they could rule indefinitely and without encountering protests from the population. The Putin regime has always sensed its own vulnerability and has an instinctive sense of its own unnaturalness. And they want to distract the population from their corruption, from their misrule. And the best way to do that is to direct the anger of the population toward an external enemy. So Russia needs the United States as a kind of target, as a plausible external threat, as a foreign power which wishes Russia ill, in order to consolidate the Russian population around the regime. And, the more insecure they feel, the more they're going to need that, and the more they're going to demonstrate it. And so all of this policy of reset that has characterized U.S. Relations toward Russia is actually beside the point, because Russian relations are not determined by whether or not we smile at them, whether we're hospitable, friendly, whether we boost their egos, whether we treat Russia as having privileged relations with the U.S. They're dictated by something completely different, the internal situation in Russia, and the extent to which the regime feels that it is in control. And we can't affect that, and we certainly can't support it, because that would be contrary to our values. So when Edward Snowden flew to Moscow, he actually was choosing a very good destination from his point of view, because nothing, he gave the Russians an opportunity to, on the one hand, ridicule the United States, demonstrate to the Russian public their ability to stand up to the United States, irrespective of the merits of the case, and at the same time, he helped worsen U.S.-Russian relations in a way that will spawn even further conflicts and angry exchanges in the future, making it that much easier for Putin to depict himself as the defender of Russia against a hostile West, a hostile United States.
Your advice then to President Obama and Secretary Kerry would be what? About the immediate situation and what to do.
As far as the immediate situation, I, in fact, was one of those who signed a letter calling on President Obama to cancel the summit meeting with President Putin, which he did do. It was the first time that I've called on him to do anything when he actually did it. I think that we have to understand the true nature of the Russian regime, that this is a criminal state, as I stated. When I used that title in 2003, when the book came out, people thought it was extreme. Now it's taken for granted. And we should behave toward Russia accordingly. We have to have, there are certain things about which we can agree, but it is not we are not obliged to raise their prestige, to massage their ego, to attribute to them a legitimacy they don't deserve, and we're most of all not obliged to sacrifice to good relations with the Putin regime our hopefully long-term interest in a democratic future for the Russian people. And we can't support that long-term goal without expressing ourselves frankly and making clear, enunciating the values which underpin our own society.
There are echoes in what you just said of George Kennan. Does that lead you to the point where you say, ultimately, we have to contain this present regime until it changes?
I don't think it's a similar situation now, because the Russian regime is not expansionist in the way that the Soviet Union,
to be sure,
was. It does not have an ideology. It's a small group of people dedicated to their own survival. We have to contain it only in the sense that we have to contain our own inclination to engage in effusive gestures of goodwill, which in fact only make us vulnerable to behavior like the type of behavior we witnessed over Edward Snowden. The Russians' leaders, in their depiction of U.S.-Russian relations for a Russian audience, try to make the point that Obama is a fool, what he says makes no sense, that all this talk of democracy is a lie, that the United States is motivated by its own aggressive interests, that the Russian regime, i.e. Putin, is standing up for Russia, is defending Russia's real interests, and that the Americans are missing no opportunity to interfere in Russian affairs where they absolutely don't belong. Well, we encourage that, in effect, and implicitly reinforce it when we demonstrate, when we have great shows of respect for Putin. I mean, there were 20 countries at the G20 meeting. Why was it necessary to have a separate meeting with Putin? Is he that important? Why was it necessary for President Bush, for example, to invite Putin to his family home in Kennebunkport, something he had done for no other head of state? Why was it important for President Obama to invite the Russian president at that time, although he was the kind of a pseudo-president, Dmitry Medvedev, to his favorite hamburger place in Arlington, Virginia? The thing is that if there were real relations of trust between Russia and the U.S., such gestures would not be necessary. And in the absence of a relationship of trust, you know, making such gestures just makes us look like a fool.
David, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the time you've spent with us today and the wisdom and clarity of information and the meaning of information that you've provided in this discussion. It just confirms me in my thought that when many of us on the faculty at the University of Chicago wrote letters of supporting your application for a Rhodes Fellowship, a Rhodes Scholarship at Oxford, we were right. You proved us right for all the following years.
Well, thanks. I would feel terrible if you regretted it.
It's one of the things I most remember fondly from my many years at the university. Thank you so much for joining us. And Godspeed on your next trip to Russia. How long will you be staying?
I'll be there for at least a year. I'm going to be working on the book and also serving as an advisor to Radio Liberty.
Yes, wonderful. Thanks again, old friend.
Okay, Mel. Many thanks.